Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Over the weekend, we saw shock and protests from Los Angeles to Florida to Boston over the acquittal of George Zimmerman and the shooting death of 19-year-old Trayvon Martin. Today, there's a deeper effort to understand the meaning of the verdict, in particular, what it means to African-American communities across the nation and around this city.
Yesterday evening, about 500 people rallied in Roxbury's Dudley Square and then marched along Malcolm X Boulevard to protest the verdict. Ministers across the city called for peace and healing, even as they expressed solidarity for Trayvon Martin and his family.
Willie Bodrick II is a youth minister who chose to wear a hoodie in support of Trayvon Martin's family when he spoke yesterday at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury, and he joins us now. And Willie Bodrick, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, both of you all, for having me.
Also with us is Patricia Rose. She's director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University, and she joins us by cell phone from on her way to Kennedy Airport. Tricia, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, too.
And listeners, we want to ask you what you're thinking about this weekend's verdict in the case of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. What does it say about race and justice in America, about racial stereotypes, and also, significantly, about gun laws? How do we learn from this and move forward? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me start with you, if I could, Tricia Rose. Your reaction, first of all, I'd love to just catch up with you and just understand how you reacted to this.
Well, my first reaction was real sadness, you know, a sadness that I was fighting to avoid turning into despair and sort of a kind of rage. You know, I didn't mind being angry. It's reasonable to be angry about this. But, you know, rage is a dangerous thing when you know as much as I know, which, you know, as a professor who teaches history of and culture and social issues for African Americans, when you know that level of information, it's very difficult not to become, you know, just overwhelmed. So I really fought with that for a while. And then, you know, I thought, you know, this could be a really powerful turning point where, you know, maybe the silver lining is that we stop living in this narrative, you know, fantasy world that we've constructed, and that maybe this is the tipping point. So, you know, that's sort of where I ended up, to say, you know, yeah, to move to that more positive way of thinking about it.
And what is that fantasy world that we've been living in? This idea of post-racial America, for example, is that part of the fantasy?
Yes, Anthony. In fact, before post-racial, we invented this fiction that colorblindness ideal, and some of Americans have, particularly Reagan was the beginning of this, manipulated King's language about not judging someone based on their color of their skin, but the content of their character, and turned that into an illusion that not accounting for race, not accounting for ethnic or cultural differences or experiences or lived experiences based on race, that not accounting for that was going to actually end, you know, the staggering levels of disparity based on race that we see. And it's completely irrational on its face, and yet it relieved people of a certain kind of responsibility. It sort of said, if I don't see your race and I say I don't see it, then I'm not accountable or responsible for all the things that might happen to you based on it. And that's where we've been for quite a while. It really took hold, and Obama's election in some ways made it worse. It's not really his fault to my mind, but, you know, it made it worse, and we turned into this illusion that we're not only colorblind, we're post-race. And there's no evidence for this. So this gap has really, I think, helped us deny not just what happened to Trayvon, but what goes on with the jails that are filled with young black men for mostly no reason at all, very illegitimate reason and unjustly, and we just have no discussion about it, no major policy initiative.
Well, Tricia Rose, I want to come back, and you, when you talk about the silver lining, might be that there is a way to sort of turn the corner and sort of push this conversation forward, and I'm going to come back to you on that, but let me come over to Willie Bodrick, who's the youth minister at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. And Willie, you spoke yesterday at the church. You were wearing a hoodie. Tell me what was going through your mind, your reaction.
Well, my initial reaction was just being stunned. and not stunned just because of the verdict, but stunned that this is still happening, that black male presence in this country is still being treated as objects rather than humans. And for me, having a sermon already prepared and ready for Sunday, having to take a step back and reassess some of the things that were happening in my life and my experiences, but also reassess, where does this sit and posit us in America at this time, at this juncture in this country? It's 2013. And as one who has understood its history in a certain context, it is very important for me to utilize this moment not as a moment of defeat, but as a moment of desire towards changing the narrative around black male existence in this country. And so before I stood in the pulpit, I asked my pastor, the Reverend Dr. Arthur C. Gerald at 12th Baptist, would he allow me to use this symbol, a symbol that I thought would speak more than words, a symbol that I thought represented those who look just like me, those who look just like Trayvon, and even those who look just like the president, a symbol that represented that black maleness, being in solidarity and understanding the context of what is happening in America, because as Ms. Patricia said, this can be a turning point. And as I was talking earlier, this could be the turning of the tide.
And so how would we do that? What is the next step? How would we sort of turn the tide, use this as an opportunity to turn the tide, if you will?
Well, the message of peace and love must be at the foundation. But we also must speak truth to power, right? And speak truth about the American narrative and not reopen wounds that have not even fully healed. We keep talking post-racial, but we haven't become a post-racist society first. And so if we're going to actively move towards a progress, first step is changing images, changing perceptions. How do we view and see each other? To act like this country is colorblind is almost disrespectful in many ways, because we're disregarding a heritage of a people, or whoever you might be, whatever your race or your creed in this country, you're disregarding a heritage that brought you into this supposed melting pot that we call America. And that's what makes us beautiful, not the distance that we are apart, but the diversity that we have, and in that diversity finding common humanity. And I think the first part is actually looking at perceptions and changing the way in which we see people and see each other, especially in particularly this situation, black males.
Tricia Rose, let me come back to you. I mean, I'd like to sort of follow up on the point you made that I think Willie Bodrick was expressing in his way, how we use this moment. You talked about a silver lining to sort of turn this conversation in a constructive way.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, to augment Willie's really wonderful point about perception is that we have to be interested in really galvanizing all the just widespread data about the nature and scope of structural discrimination in the United States right now, and how it's been going on, say, for the past 25 years. In other words, what we don't want to do is simply go to images alone or to feelings or beliefs, but how these things play out structurally, because they're extraordinarily systemic. And I think that's really going to be about education, and it's got to be about using the media, using the internet, using the wide range of genius people we have in all academic and intellectual and research walks of life who've done extraordinary work showing how perception and how images and how economic discrimination and how unemployment data, education, health, housing, every possible indicator, the racial disparity is not just noticeable, but staggering. So we have to look at that, and we have to confront that. And then we have to challenge this notion that behavior has produced this. Now, I'm not suggesting behavior doesn't matter. I'm sure, Willie would agree that, you know, how we treat each other really matters, right? And how we treat ourselves really matter. But the use of behavior has been really a slap in the face and a dehumanizing emphasis given the conditions that people are trying to survive. And I think that's what the core of our conversation needs to start being about. And just one last point, we don't want to be in a sort of angry, blame-based conversation, because there are many, many, many wonderful, both activists and everyday people of every racial group who agree with this problem, who see it as a problem.
Tricia Rose, stand by. I'd love to get a couple of callers into this conversation. Let's go to Philip, who's calling from Newton. Hi, Philip, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to raise a point about something that's sort of been scaring me in recent days since the verdict came down, which is the surprise that I see from a lot of people at the verdict and at the reaction to the verdict. Because sort of, for instance, the judge's instructions to not consider race in the trial, I think, are indicative of our hope, our illusion that if we ignore racial stereotyping and racial bias in law and in society, it'll go away. And I think it's almost, in a scary way, succeeded to a degree where people are surprised that this happens to black teenagers in America, when in fact, maybe not of this magnitude, but events of this bias happen every day and are not addressed.
Philip, it's a great point. And Tricia Rose, I'm actually glad that Philip brought up this particular set of instructions from Judge Deborah Nelson, where she basically ruled that the prosecution could not argue that Trayvon Martin was racially profiled. And this leads me to a question. I mean, I understand the reaction to this decision, but to what extent is the result of this case the result of the particular proceedings in that courtroom, as opposed to, you know, a problem that stems perhaps across the nation?
Well, I mean, every individual case has its own characteristics and quirks that explain why a condition, an outcome takes place. But it would be absurd not to put that trial and how it proceeded, whether or not Zimmerman was going to be arrested or questioned as you know, a potential antagonist in the incident. That all of that has deep context. And in fact, one of the major disturbing aspects of the way the media has covered all of this is to hyper-individuate, right? To sort of think of this only as an individual thing and never give the in-depth context. I mean, there's so much evidence to show the patterns of circumstance that frame this one case. So that instruction from the judge is extremely important, but even if she hadn't given it, I don't think that it would have undone the idea that race was somehow to be avoided, right? Mm-hmm. And that race was somehow not a relevant fact. And one other thing from Philip, which is a really important point, is that we've created this illusion, and so the outrage and the shock make people want to treat it as an exception. Oh, this must have been an exception. Or maybe this Trayvon kid, who knows, one bad apple, but the system's okay. Or structural racism doesn't really structure everything all that much for people. It's just this one kid and this one thing. That is the most dangerous potential outcome, it seems to me.
Willie Bodrick, I want to ask you about a particular sort of reaction from the community. This morning, NPR's Gene Demby talked about a question he put on Twitter about how black parents talk to their kids about this verdict. And particularly, he asked them about the conversation, about how black parents need to prepare their kids to deal with authority, to deal with cops, to deal with situations in which Trayvon Martin found himself. I'm wondering if that has come up in the community and the folks that you've talked to.
I think it could not. How could it not come
up?
You know, we want to buy into this narrative that America has progressed to a place where I can walk freely. But I think we've seen instance after instance showing us very clearly that we are not there. And if we're going to be realistic about this progressive change, then we have to be realistic about where we are in America at this moment. And so these conversations are coming up. I think education is key. Knowing your basic rights, that's one of the biggest things. Knowing just some of the basic things about walking around, having your ID on you. You have to prepare yourselves. I think my parents, raising three black boys in the inner city of Atlanta, Georgia, were very keen on making sure that their young black boys understood that when you walked out in the world, you're going to face some things. You're going to have to deal with these things. And in our first encounters of race, they tried to use those as teaching moments about our history, about where we come from, and about how we have evolved in this country as a people and where we've come from. I mean, if we understand our history, we know very clearly that we weren't even acknowledged fully as human beings at one point in our history by the law. And so we're constantly fighting this battle, and we have to use this as a teaching moment for all of our children and prepare them, because if we're not prepared, then we won't be able to acknowledge, and we'll continue to see the systematic disenfranchisement of people, especially black people in America.
Let's go to Gwen, who's calling from Woburn. Hi, Gwen, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to say, as a mother of a 17-year-old boy, I'm really and just a citizen of America, I'm really distressed by the verdict. But I was hopeful at something one of your speakers just said about the idea of sort of a catalyst. And I was thinking about the example of Anita Hill and the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, and how though the verdict of the Senate, the all-white male Senate panel, went against what a lot of the majority of the public felt, it was the beginning. It wasn't the end. It was the beginning of a process of the whole country being educated about sexual harassment, and our laws have changed, and people's whole mindset has changed. And I just hope that maybe this could be the seed that's, I don't know, that something positive could come of this.
Gwen, well expressed. Let me put your comment to Tricia Rose. Do you agree with Gwen, Tricia Rose?
Yes, without a doubt. I certainly hope that. You know, I think, you know, we're here, right? So we can't go back. So the best thing to do is to make the most of it, to use the kind of the sense of, hey, how might we turn this? Don't just say, will it turn it, but how might we turn it into this tipping point moment where it doesn't just become another example of another, say, Rodney King, or another, you know, Oscar Grant, or another fill-in-the-blank high media profile case. How do we turn it into a, okay, what are we going to do now, and what are the layers of our actions in various ways? We educate our young boys, as Willie rightfully said, but we also help young people see that their commitment and activism in their communities is, and their education about social structure is crucial to this process, right? And that means developing a critical kind of engagement with society and not sort of letting it off the hook. That, you know, that's the heart of really giving up to Glenn's hopeful disposition.
You know, one of the questions that comes to my mind, Willie Bodrick, I want to ask you. You know, you're 25, I understand.
Yes,
not a whole lot older than Trayvon Martin was. I'm just curious, in your young career so far as a minister, have you dealt with anything like this, or is this a sort of one of the first sort of big issues around race and justice that you've had to talk about from a pulpit?
From a pulpit, maybe not directly at all times, but I try to talk about it, because we can't actually talk about being loving and healing and peaceful if we're not speaking out about the real issues that people are dealing with daily. But in my life, yes. How can I not? Growing up in an inner city, like Patricia said, that this is not just a new incident. There have been many cases like this. There are kids dying every single day. And this is just an opportunity for us to speak out against this. One of the things that have frustrated me the most is that people are, not only are they shocked, but they think this is the only time we're speaking out. At my church, we're doing peace walks every Friday in our communities. And churches around this country are actually fighting violence at all times and in all places. In my life, yes, I'm constantly speaking about, you know, any type of injustices that we face. And, you know, for me, it touches home, because I've had almost 6 friends be slain to violence and gun violence at that. And despite race or anything, even though it is important in this conversation, I think life and human life is important. And if we're not having that serious conversation, I think we're doing a disservice to talking about being catalysts of change, because we can't if we're not being realistic about these issues, if we're not speaking about these issues, preaching about it. And yes, this is going to aware the country of what's going on at this time. We need to speak about the subconscious and unconscious racism that happens each and every day, that plays out into the lives of the American public. And if we're continually being constructive about, you know, highlighting those issues and speaking out on those issues, then I think we have an opportunity here at the stake of a bad situation to create some type of good out of it.
It's a deep conversation. I'm really grateful to you both. Tricia Rose, we have about 30 seconds left. I just want to give you an opportunity to sort of leave us with a final thought about this before I say goodbye to you.
Well, you know, I think, you know, the most wicked and difficult problems we have require the most courage, the most reflection, and the most unflinching honesty. You know, as Willie said, not only speaking truth to power, but seeking the truth. And, you know, one of the best and most powerful elements of the African-American tradition is to respond to suffering with the power of love, right? To love through the tears. And so, and it's not just for each other, but for everyone. That's a gift that African-American culture has offered, and the world. And I think that is what we need to do now, and we need to share that as we look as closely as we can and work as hard as we can.
Tricia Rose is the director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Tricia Rose, thank you so much, and safe travels.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Willie Bodrick II is a youth minister at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. He's also a master's student at the Harvard Divinity School. Willie Bodrick, great to have you, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me as well.
And listeners, the conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. You can go there, post your comments, and stay with us. We may have universal coverage here in Massachusetts, but how easy is it to access doctors? I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston.